Blog Talk Radio.
Show. Man, I'm glad to be here. I hope you are too. I'm getting ready to go on a vacation, actually a very, very needed, badly needed vacation with Debo, my girlfriend, and she's heading up to Oregon. She's going to drive next week. And I'm going to fly up a week later and meet her up there. But, you know, I haven't been to Oregon in about a decade, and it's really grown. It's huge. And I didn't realize that there was a horticultural element to Oregon. Of course, there's a lot of rain there, but there are so many gardens. There's the International Rose Garden. There's the Lansu Chinese Garden. There's the Japanese Garden. There's Washington Park. There's Mount Hood and Hood River, and boy, I'm really looking forward to getting up there. The other aspect of my trip is to to taste some of these craft beers up there, and I discovered in my research there's over 300 craft breweries in the Portland area, and that is amazing. I'm here in San Francisco Bay Area. We have our share. I think we have maybe one, I want to say half that many, 150, maybe less, in the general greater Bay Area. But when I was reading about the history of Oregon and its development of microbrews, I was amazed to see that a lot of these guys had started in the late 1990s when you know, the idea of microbrewing was not even a concept. They were kind of doing home brewing where they were playing with different kinds of yeasts and different kinds of afterthought tastes, like a flavored beer, fruit beer. So I am looking forward to that trip, and I'm flying up on the 21st. And if you know of something about Portland that I should know about, I would really appreciate getting an email. Send me an email at cliff@earthancients.com. And, I mean, I got the places to go check out. When I was there 10 years ago, I was there on business, and I stayed a couple extra days just to kind of see what was going on around the downtown area. Oh, and Debo, my girlfriend's an artist, so we're gonna go see the art gallery there, and there's some other sites related to art that are kind of cool. But we're both outdoors people, so we're gonna go out and hike, and check out what's going on there. Anyhow, yeah, if you are from Oregon and you do know like really fantastic places that are just must see, I'd really appreciate knowing about them, because I'm going to hang out for about a week and I can check it out. cliff@earthancients.com. So we got a lot of interesting things to talk about today. Eric Von Doniggen is going to be in the program. He flew in day before yesterday, and he's in Joshua Tree, which is a desert. That's the California desert, at a conference called Contact in the Desert. And the interview was a real challenge for him because he was in a room that didn't have any air conditioning. And but we got it through anyhow. I think at the end it was probably about 100 degrees in the room. He was he says he was literally covered in water, which is covered in sweat. So that's coming up in a little bit. I want to make a couple of notes. I posted a very interesting gallery on Indonesian pyramids. And we've talked a little bit about Indonesian pyramids with the Gunung Penang pyramid in Java and Danny Hillman's work and discovering that it's significantly old. I think he's beginning to think it's over 30,000 years old. It might be even older. Those are verified dates based on carbon dating, and that's a mind blower. To build a pyramid requires very sophisticated engineering, mathematics, and so the civilization that built that pyramid in Indonesia was highly sophisticated. But this gallery, this Indonesian gallery of pyramids, features some very, very unusual, beautifully constructed, elegant pyramids in different parts of Southeast Asia that you should check out. And you can see this gallery on Earth Ancients. Go to the Facebook page and just scroll down. You'll see it. There's actually two galleries. One is part of a GIF animation where you can see up to about 15 different pyramids that slowly cycle. It's on a setup, so it's somewhat active. It's moving at about every slide is moving at about I'm going to say 3 to 5 seconds. And then there's another pyramid gallery that's just you click right through it and you can see these pyramids. Now, a couple of people, including Bruce Cunningham, who does tours out there, has said that he believes there's a parallel between the Maya ruins, pyramid ruins of Central America, Mexico, and in Yucatan, and these Indonesian pyramids that he's discovered in Java. And I've never been out to that part of the world, but I have studied enough of these photographs and read a couple of books, and I don't see the similarities whatsoever. And Bruce, if you're listening, I'm sorry, buddy, but I can't see them. That's not to say that they're not sophisticated and not very unique. I just think it's a different kind of a builder and a different kind of a design set. And the other thing that I've noticed is a lot of these pyramids are built into existing mountains, which is a whole different kind of a design idea. And I don't know. I can't comment a lot on it because I haven't been out to these places. But from what I can see, they're not similar to Mesoamerican pyramids. So that's just my opinion. So check those out. Indonesian pyramids on the Facebook page. And I think you'll find them interesting. Some of them are very beautifully constructed and elegantly placed on the ground. So the other thing I want to talk a little bit about, and we're going to see more and more about the author John Burke, who passed away in 2010. The book he wrote was called Seeds of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And I mention him continuously because, to my mind, he is the only researcher, scientific research authority on pyramid construction and why they built over these telluric fields, these geomagnetic fields, why the megalithic builders, why the pyramid builders actually chose these areas to build on. And I discovered a short description, YouTube presentation that John gave in 2009 at a conference where he describes how he started, what he discovered, and the importance of these fields. Now, he had a history of developing various field energy to increase the strength and properties of farm seeds. And so his interest was in seed propagation, seed strength and vitality to grow the best crops possible. And so when he went out to these pyramids in Mexico, and in fact, the book describes his visit to a number of pyramids, specifically in Tikal. He went to the New World Pyramid and did some amazing testing. But he spent a great deal of time in all parts of the world testing megalithic sites. And this, I'm going to play a short clip of him explaining what he discovered. And this clip is a video that I've placed on the Facebook page. And you can go to the Facebook page, Earth Ancients, and you can actually see him talking about what we're going to hear here. And I only took about a short 5-minute clip that we'll hear. And you can hear the entire presentation on Facebook. But here's John explaining what his work is.
I'm really a New York businessman with a scientific background. This is an avocation for me, but certainly not a profession. But fortunately, the business that I was working in back in 1993 involved using very low-energy electron showers, in other words, very low-energy electromagnetic forces, to treat agricultural seeds. And the result was dramatic improvements that have been verified several hundred times by third parties like universities and seed companies and whatnot. So I was lucky to be in that frame of mind when in 1993, myself and my co-author, Kai Halberg, stumbled into a situation at Avebury Henge in England, which is sort of the grandfather or the godfather of Stonehenge, where it looked like maybe something similar was going on here. And we spent the next 3 weeks doing 1,000 measurements to confirm that, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But the point is, it started us off on a quest that's been ongoing ever since, to go to one location after another. And so far, we've measured over 80 sites personally using standard scientific instruments, because one thing I wanted to make sure was that this was something that could be accepted by the scientific field in general, because they're standard instruments that anybody can use, and the forces are still there, and you can go back and confirm them. So what we are talking about is this certain set of coincidences, if that's what you want to be skeptical and call them, that throughout the world, whatever we've been able to find, with only a couple of exceptions out of those 80, overwhelmingly the architects of megalithic structures, henges, pyramids, you name it, chose to site their buildings directly on top of a certain very special type of geology that dramatically amplifies the normal electromagnetic fluctuations that take place on the Earth every day. And that's the Earth that is the engine that drives all this. But they knew how to spot these spots where there was this special geology, and then they would design and then build out of materials that would further concentrate these energies several hundred percent. And the interesting part is, coming from the state of mind that I was, it occurred to me, could they have been doing it in order to increase food production? Because that's what we were able to do with similar types of energies. So we started doing experiments in line with that, and as you'll see, we got repeated results that were statistically significant, often at high levels, that were exactly that. And when we get to the chronology and started to look at that, in location after location, these structures were being built usually at a time when there was a food crisis on hand because of the growth of population and the exhaustion of the soil. In an era before 1000 BC, no one in the world knew anything about fertilizer or crop rotation. So soil was exhausted in 3 years, and you had to move to a new field. When all the land had been used up, you were in bad shape because your population had grown and your yields were falling. And so this was what I'd been working in, and this is why it occurred to me. So what we did was take some standard scientific instruments to these sites, and they included a fluxgate magnetometer measuring the magnetic changes in each spot. And these changes that I'm going to talk about here take place everywhere on the Earth every day. The next one was an electrostatic voltmeter, which measures the electrification of the air or a stone that might be electrified. And the third was these special geological type electrodes that are used by the USGS that you simply stick in the ground, you connect by maybe 100 feet of wire, you get a voltmeter in the middle there, and it will measure these natural telluric currents that are simply natural electric currents running through the ground. Okay? Now, the engine for all this is the Earth's magnetic field. And essentially, every day, the strength of the Earth's magnetic field strengthens because of its interaction with the solar wind. Then it drops off at night and gets much weaker everywhere, every day. You know, your backyard, your bedroom, every spot on the Earth. Certain of these geologies will concentrate that, but we all experience this. Then what happens is in the pre-dawn hours, the few hours right before dawn, the geomagnetic field in every spot comes rushing back to closer to full strength very quickly in the few hours before dawn. It's the most dramatic time of the day for that type of change. And that means if you want to study this, you have to be out in the field at 3 a.m., which is not the most pleasant passion, but that is what generates a thing called a physical principle that's called induction. Whenever you have a fluctuating magnetic field anywhere, it's simple physics, induction, that it also generates an electrical current in anything present that will conduct electricity. That's actually how our power plants are run and how we get the lights we have here. The power plants that we have to put energy into are basically just moving a giant electromagnet past a giant amount of copper wiring and it generating an electric field every time that change happens that runs through the wires that becomes the lifeblood of our industrial civilization. So there's nothing mysterious about this. There's nothing esoteric. It's very well-known principles. But we began to find that in certain spots where these megaliths were, these daily forces were much more powerful, several times more powerful, and that had some dramatic results, as you're going to see here.
So that's John explaining what he discovered, the equipment he used, and I added up what the amount of cost was that he would drag these equipment. He had about $10,000 worth of equipment that he brought out, probably more like $15,000 to do testing. And what he has left us is a basic understanding of some of this pyramid technology and how these ancients were able to build on top of these geomagnetic fields. You guys hear me talking about this constantly, constantly, constantly. It's in my brain. It's such a huge discovery that a number of researchers are beginning to use. It's so important that I'm actually beginning to write a book on Mesoamerican pyramids. And I tend to disagree with John a little bit. He believes that they would build a pyramid complex to do seed propagation. To my mind, that's a huge undertaking just to get some seeds to enhance. I mean, some of these pyramids are 60 to over 120 feet in the air, and the engineering and man hours to put that together, not to mention the stones that had to be specifically carved in a manner that creates a pyramid. And the other thing is we're beginning to understand that pyramid shapes also are conductors in certain ways. So this is an industry, this is a technology that we are just beginning to understand, just now opening up to understand that these pyramids were some form of a generator that not only helped propagation, but also helped human physiology, and I believe were used to generate energy to power probably some form of device or machines thousands of years ago. So John Burke is has opened the door for and opened the eyes of not only myself, but a number of other authors who will, we've had on our program and we will continue to have as we understand Earth Ancients and how they functioned. Okay, so here is the interview with Eric Van Doneghan. He was at the Contact in the Desert, and that continues into this weekend. If you're down in the L.A. area, see if you can get a hold. I mean, the thing about it is there. I would only go to hear Graham Hancock, who flew in to do that show. David Hatcher Childress has some interesting topics. Although I spent a great deal of my time as a young person reading Eric's books, in fact, I read Chariot of the Gods when I was a young, very young person, and kept it in my library for a long time. I remember being fascinated by his theories. I'm having Eric on the program because a lot of his thought is quite interesting, and he believes that as does Graham Hancock, that there was a very high civilization prior to a devastation, an earth change, an asteroid hit that wiped the surface clean of the civilization. Whether this was Atlantis or other cultures around the world who did have high technology similar to ours, in fact, in some ways even more advanced. Had flying machines, had underwater machines, had very high IQs, understood human physiology different than we do, used more naturalistic healing techniques like acupuncture and herbs and things like that, rather than the current medical system, which is irradiate, burn, and prescribe powerful drugs, which I don't believe is naturalistic at all. But anyhow, I don't agree a lot on the whole ancient alien hypothesis, but I'm not going to spend time here going over that. Here is the interview. I hope you like it. And at the end, I'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about the next guest.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
This is Cliff.
Hi, this is Eric Van Doneghan.
Eric, hello. Fantastic.
Are you waiting for me?
I can hear you perfectly. So,
okay.
Hey, welcome to California.
Yeah, that's okay. I arrived yesterday, Switzerland, a long trip, 13-hour flight.
Amazing. Well, listen, it's really a pleasure to have you on the program, and I want to congratulate you and wish you a happy birthday. I just discovered you just turned 81
Yeah, that's
April.
Okay, but that was in April. It's over now.
Okay, well, I mean, how do you stay so fit, Eric? You travel the whole world.
No,
genes or what?
No, the gods love me. My brain functions perfect. My body functions perfect. Just
you've written close to 40 books on the subject of the ancient alien theme.
Yes.
Who were your early influencers? Who were people when you started this journey that really made
you
think that, there was an influence?
Okay. I am Swiss. I was educated in Switzerland as a Catholic. And during my education, I was for 6 years in a Catholic boarding school led by Jesuits. And there we had to translate parts of the Bible from one language to the other, for example, Greek to Latin, Latin to German. And when I was a boy, of course, I was a very, very deep believer in God. I am still a deep believer in God. But for me, God had to have some qualities, minimum qualities. For example, God would make no mistake. Or God would never use a vehicle in which to move around from point A to point B. God is all over. Now, while making these translations of the Bible, I realized that the God of the Bible is not perfect. He makes mistakes. he uses a chariot to fly from point A to point B. And he makes noise. He descends from the sky with smoke and fire and loud noise and trembling and all these things. So I simply had doubts in my own religious education. And I wanted to know if other communities in antiquity have similar stories than we have it. So that was the beginning of Chariot of the Gods and all my writings.
Okay, so it was a biblical sense that something is different in the history.
Yes.
From a religious point of view. Is there anyone you can name that you would say was an influence as you were growing up, say when you began to actually, maybe in your 30s, when you began to actually go out and locate these ancient ruins, that someone who was an influence on you, a book or something?
No. No.
Wow.
You see, the Bible was the big thing. You see, in the Bible, for example, we have the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel describes a flying chariot descending from the sky. He even describes the noise. He describes the wheels, the wings, and all these things. So Ezekiel is a very clear case. If you ask if someone influenced me, it was Ezekiel. Later in my education, I came together with the book of Enoch. Enoch, again, was a biblical prophet before the Great Flood. But what nobody knows, Enoch is also the writer of a book, the Book of Enoch. This book was found 170 years ago in an old library in Ethiopia. So when I read Enoch, I was completely influenced, because Enoch writes in the first person what happened. He writes that these so-called angels descended with smoke, fire, loud noise, trembling, and so on. And they took him into the sky. Of course, they took him in reality into a model spaceship. He learns their language. He understands their language. They give him education in science. For example, one of the extraterrestrials says to Enoch, "Man, human, look out of the window. Do you see this little light there? You humans call it moon, but the moon has no light by itself. The moon receives its light from the sun." And then he describes him all the phases of the moon. You know, why is it full moon? Why is it half moon, etc.? He describes him that the sun is just one of the stars of many other stars. Our planet is surrounding the sun in 365 days, including leap hours, etc., etc. So this is scientific information which Enoch received before the Great Flood. So that all was in Stone Age time. So I know, of course, that our ancestors, they also had natural religions. They were afraid of an earthquake. They were afraid of maybe the lightning and the thundering and all these things. But natural religions is not the same thing like extraterrestrials, because extraterrestrials, they gave information, scientific information. They teach the humans. And that's the difference between natural religions and the influence of the extraterrestrials.
What, you know, you've traveled the world locating what you believe is evidence of ancient aliens. Can you give us, I mean, there's Belbek with the megaliths of huge stones. There's Teotihuacan in Mexico, these amazing pyramids. But what would you say, in your mind, is the best evidence for ancient aliens' sophisticated technology?
Well, normally, all these gigantic buildings and temples, things which we have on Earth, like the Great Pyramid, etc., they were all made by humans. It was not the extraterrestrials who made these constructions. It was always the humans. The question is, why have the humans done it? The normal answer is, well, for religion. For religion. What religion? And then you end again with extraterrestrials. But in some cases, the extraterrestrials have made some constructions just in the sense of a basic camp. You see, when our mountain climber, they go to the Himalaya, they use basic camps because they don't want to carry all the time their material with them. The same thing with extraterrestrials. In the highland of Bolivia, there is a place called Puma Punku. And the natives, they told the Spanish some 400 years ago that they did not make them. They did not construct this Puma Punku. It was the gods from the sky who did it in one simple night. Now I could imagine that the extraterrestrials, they used a basic camp for their, you know, to store their equipment. They don't want to carry all everything on their back. So with their technology, they constructed Pumapunku in one night. And you can still see it today. This is so impressive, the cutting of the gigantic stone blocks. And the stone blocks are granite, very, very hard. So the Stone Age people at that time in the highland of Bolivia, there is no wood for wooden rollers, etc. You are 4,000 meters high. So you are absolutely influenced. This is not human technology. In Pumapunku, you can prove that here tools and methods were used which our forefathers in Stone Age time never had.
Fascinating. Yeah, Pumapunku is a very interesting thing. You're a special guest at a conference at Joshua Tree Desert in California. It's called Contact in the Desert. And
yes.
You're there with a number of other authors who are speaking on UFOs, ancient aliens, and things. But one of the other featured speakers there is a guy named Graham Hancock.
I just saw the program a few minutes ago, and I just realized here in Joshua Tree, Contact in the Desert, there are 43 speakers. Of course, Giorgio Tuscalos is here. Everyone knows Giorgio Tuscalos from the Ancient Alien series. And I am here, Eric von Däniken, Stanton Friedman is here, Robert Beauval is here, he's a specialist in Egyptology, etc. 43 speakers. This is a gigantic conference. When you are here, you can decide which speakers you want to listen to. You don't have, you don't can listen to all the 43 speakers.
Yeah, they have everybody doing quite a bit of activity, lectures and special workshops and things. My question for you, though, is in his newest book, Graham Hancock talks about his new book's called A Magician of the Gods. He talks about the newest evidence of a huge, horrific cataclysm that befell the inhabitants of Earth about 9,500 years ago, actually 12,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And he describes a highly sophisticated people that may have been on the Earth, and this may have been people who were in Atlantis, maybe people who were in Mexico, that basically were wiped out. Is it your understanding and your theory that those people may have been highly educated, but they were influenced by alien forefathers?
You see, I know Graham Hancock very good. He's here too. He's a speaker here, if you want to listen to him. And I know Graham Hancock does not have the same opinion as I have. I absolutely agree. We might have had a high civilization some 10 or 9,000 years ago. This is absolutely possible. But a high civilization does not exclude at the same time a contact with extraterrestrials. Because all the old writings, the holy writings, and I'm a specialist in holy writings worldwide, they always say that the gods descended from sky, from heaven. It was not the earthlings. It was the so-called gods who influenced mankind at that time. So the humans learned a lot of things, technology and all kinds of things, but they learned it from the so-called gods, the extraterrestrials. In all these holy books, the gods have come down with smoke, fire, trembling, loud noise, etc., and different humans, I know at least 12 humans have been brought up there into the sky. They were in the spaceship. They describe what happened up there. So this does not disprove Graham Hancock's idea. You can have both at the same time. You can have a wonderful civilization with technology and at the same time contact with extraterrestrials. It's not just one or the other. You have both.
Interesting. You know, in a number of your books, you describe the ruler, the Maya ruler, King Pakal, who oversaw the city of Palenque in Chiapas, which is present-day Chiapas, Mexico. And it's fascinating because your theory of this sarcophagus that he's buried underneath shows him in what appears to be a spaceship. But my question for you is, was Pakal a hybrid of an alien, or was he just a very bright guy who took some early codices, Maya codices, and perhaps use that knowledge in the kingdom?
No, in my opinion, Pakal was a human. He was not a hybrid. He was not an extraterrestrial. Pakal was the second last ruler of the city of Palenque. But the same Pakal must have had contact with extraterrestrials. And then, you see, to give you just the general impression in connection with Pakal, around the Earth, we have a mother spaceship. From the mother spaceship, smaller vehicles came down, like we did it. We went with the Saturn V to the moon, then smaller vehicles surrounded the moon, and then another smaller vehicle made the landing of the moon, and then another smaller vehicle, the so-called moon car, was running around the moon. Now, the same thing with extraterrestrials. There's a mother spaceship, smaller vehicles coming down, and on Earth, they used, again, smaller vehicles. And Pakal was in contact with one of these beings, and he maybe was driving on one of these smaller vehicles. And when he died, they chiseled the smaller vehicle on a gigantic stone. The stone is gigantic because it's 3 meters 80 long, 2 meters 20 large. And you see Pakal sitting in this vehicle. The vehicle is not a terrestrial vehicle. The vehicle is an extraterrestrial vehicle, but not a spaceship. Just something like an extraterrestrial car which moves on the surface on our planet. It's not a spaceship with which you can move to the stars. So Pakal knew this vehicle, and they chiseled the vehicle on the stone. That's my idea.
Interesting. Yeah. So your feeling about Pakal was that he wasn't a hybrid. He was a human. But
he was human, yes.
But at the time of his rule, there may have been some alien influence,
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, so there wasn't any codices that you think. It was more of just an influence by these ambassadors. Maybe you can call
you
them
see,
ambassadors.
You see, on this stone of Palenque, you see Pakal sitting. He's sitting in a sort of frame, inside a frame. He's bending forward almost like a racing motorcyclist. With his two hands, he uses his two hands to manipulate some control. He's sitting on a chair, and outside of the frame, you see a linking flame. So all this is a vehicle, and they chiseled it in stone. But the man sitting in there was a human, was Pakal, was not an extraterrestrial. And now this stone slab has a writing on the side, and only part of the writing could be translated. And this part, which is translated, clearly say that Pakal was in contact with the ones from heaven, from the sky. So he knew them. He had contact with them, but he was a human.
Interesting. Okay. You talk a great deal in your book about the pyramids and just the whole design and their function. It's coming out now through a number of works that some of these pyramids were actual generators, energy generators. There was a researcher in America who just passed away named John Burke, who studied pyramids in the Americas, Mexican pyramids and in Tikal. And apparently a lot of them are built over geomagnetic energy fields, which are naturally occurring fields that bubble up out of the earth. And he believes that they were used in these pyramids. Do you have any kind of theory behind this pyramid culture that is so prevalent around the world?
You see, in my point of view, the Great Pyramid was made by humans, but with the help, the technology, the planning of extraterrestrials. In the past 4 years, more and more shafts and rooms were discovered in the Great Pyramid and also under the pyramid. There, you know, some 2,500 years ago, there was a Greek historian. His name was Herodotus. Herodotus was in Egypt. And Herodotus was the writer of two books about Egypt. And in his second book, he wrote that under the Great Pyramid, there is a lake with clear water. And in the water, covered by water, there is a gigantic sarcophagus. Now, archaeology always thought, what the hell is Herodotus writing? That's all garbage. There cannot be a lake under the Great Pyramid. In the meantime, this lake was discovered. I was down there. I showed the pictures here in Joshua Tree, in my speak. There is a lake, absolutely clear water, and in the water is a sarcophagus. So Herodotus was right. The same thing, the same Herodotus, in his second book of history, he says he was in Thebes. Thebes is today's city of Luxor on the Nile. And he said, the high priest showed me 241 statues, statues of dead people. And the high priest explained from every statue the name which is represented on this stone statue, etc. And at the end, the high priest said to Herodotus, these 241 statues represent 11,340 years. At that time, the gods from the firmament were among the humans. Since that time, the gods have not returned. So Herodotus made this statement 2,500 years ago. He speaks of 11,340 years. So from today, we have to add 2,500 years from now to Herodotus, which means more or less 14,000 years ago, the extraterrestrials were here, according to Herodotus. Now, the extraterrestrials, they did not construct the pyramid, but they made the planning. The planning is so damned complicated because you have many new shafts. You don't have only the two rooms, so-called the king's chamber and the queen's chamber, which the tourists know. In the meantime, we have 12 different chambers and shafts located in the Great Pyramid and under the pyramid. So the planning is impossibly complicated. It's nothing for Cheops. You see, Cheops, officially, archaeologists say Cheops was the constructor of the Great Pyramid. Cheops was a man of the 4th dynasty. That was 2,500 years ago. Cheops' father, his name was Snorfu, came directly from Stone Age. At that time, they did not have the technology and the planning for such a complicated construction with 12 rooms and shafts in the Great Pyramid. So the planning was coming from outside. And I am sure we will, in the next months or years, we will find some writings, books, inside the Great Pyramid. And that's exactly what the old Arabian writers say. They say inside the pyramid is all the knowledge, what the humans knew before the Great Flood. So the pyramid is much older than what Egyptologists believe.
So you think that the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, might be at least 10,000 years or older?
At least, yes.
Okay. And, you know, you've talked about the position of the pyramids in a number of your books. The author, Robert Bovall, believes that the pyramid is facing the constellation of Orion, and that has some significance. What would be the significance in your mind
that? Robert Bovall, I know him very good. He's also a speaker here, by the way. He is absolutely right. You see, the oldest Egyptian god was Osiris. But Osiris, in Egyptian language, also in hieroglyphic writing, is the same thing as Orion. So if you use the word Orion, or if you use the word Osiris, it's the same. Osiris is Orion. And the three pyramids are absolutely located in a way. I cannot explain this in English. It's too complicated here with the noise in this office. The three pyramids are located in a way that they point exactly to the belt of Orion. I think Bovall is perfectly right here.
Okay, interesting. One of your contemporaries is Zachariah Sitchin, and Sitchin talks about the Anunnaki, which were hybrids. Do you have a feeling about that in terms of hybrid humans, and these were giants, and if we are hybrids?
Definitely. Yeah, you see, in old Egypt, there was a priest with the name Manetho. Manetho was also a historian. The books of Manetho do not exist anymore, except a few pages. But we had, in the 4th century, we had a man with the name Eusebius. Eusebius was one of the historians and the father of the Christian church. Now, Eusebius, he was also an historian. In his books, he uses a lot of material of Manetho, the Egyptian. historian. So, and Eusebius quotes Manetho that the so-called gods, they made hybrids. They made different sorts of animals. He describes there were humans with wings. There were lions with human heads, etc. So there was definitely hybrids in old Egypt. They made it for experience, definitely. And they also made human hybrids. This is written by Manetho, and the father of the church, Eusebius, has it in his books. So this is for me a fact. We find a lot of pictures. You find statues in every big museum. You see some of these hybrids. What is the Sphinx? The Sphinx is the body of a lion with the head of a pharaoh. So this is a mixture. This is a hybrid. And in Egypt, there are hundreds of different sphinxes. There's not only the one sphinx. There are different hybrids, which you see in stone. You see it in sculptures. So the old writers, they were right. There were hybrids, and they were still chiseled in stone. And by the way, as soon as we can prove this, and I know it's very easy to prove it. All we need is a little bone, and we need a genetic analysis. Soon as we know for sure that there were hybrids, then we have a proof for extraterrestrials, because our ancestors, thousands of years ago, they knew nothing about genetics, nothing about genetical design. So if we have a hybrid proof, that proves at the same time that someone must have had the knowledge of genetical design, and that's only the extraterrestrials. We on human, we humans, thousands of years ago, we did not have genetic design.
Hmm.
So you can prove the extraterrestrial, the existence by hybrids, by the bones of hybrids.
Yeah, the genetic testing. I want to ask you, you must be familiar with the people of Paracas when they have these amazingly long skulls that for many years scientists thought, well, it's all head binding, but it's proving to be wrong that these are naturally occurring big people. They have extremely large brains and bodies and heads. And one of the researchers down there, a guy named Brian Forster, did some research, and apparently their genetic code is very different. In fact, there's some very unusual coding down there. Are you familiar with those Paracas people?
Yes. Yeah. You see, it's not only in Paracas. Paracas is one example with this elongated head. But you also have these heads in Egypt. You had them in Sumeria. Worldwide, you have this phenomenon of this elongated head. I'm sorry, English is not my language. You should make this whole thing in German or in French. So anyhow, and for me, this again is a proof of extraterrestrials. We know from Peru, when the Spanish conquerors arrived, they saw that the natives, they used the head of children, just fresh-born children, babies, and they really pressed the head in a way that the head has become longer. But when the head is longer compared to a normal human being, the brain is still the same amount. The brain is not bigger. So you have a water head, which means if you do this on human babies, and they have done it, definitely, when the baby grows, the brain is not growing. It's just the head, the bones who are growing. Inside the bones, you have water, which means you are an idiot or a stupid.
Yeah.
So, the extraterrestrials, they were not stupid. They had some of these long heads. There are pictures, for example, in Egypt, where some of the pharaohs had children on their knees, and they have this elongated head again. So,
it's fascinating. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what you believe? You speak about the Mayan king Pakal and some other Mayan influences, but you know the Maya are such an interesting culture because of this pyramid complexes that they build everywhere, and because we don't have the technology to understand it now, but it's slowly coming to light. It seems like they built these huge pyramids over underground water systems, and they've discovered at Teotihuacan that pyramid of the serpent was built on top of a geomagnetic field. And then a couple of months ago, they found huge amounts of mercury in underneath the pyramid. So this is a culture that is using technology we don't know about. What do you say about that? What's your feeling about that?
The oldest Maya city is Tikal. Now, in Tikal, there is no water. There is no river, there is no lake, nothing. Now, normally, if a leader of a group of people wants to settle down, the first thing they need is water. But in Tikal, there is no water. Now, some writings were found in Tikal which said they decided to make Tikal on this place because it was the place where the gods had been landed. So they made water tubes. The next lake is 40 kilometers away from Tikal. Now, they found mercury. They found mercury in Teotihuacan. They found mercury also in Tikal, in Copan, on the pyramid. Now, I must make a little detour. In ancient India, we have these descriptions of the so-called Vimanas. Vimanas were flying machines, not spacecraft, not mother spaceship. Vimanas was something which we would call today space shuttle. So you have a mother spaceship, and from the mother spaceship you need smaller vehicles. And in India, these smaller vehicles are called Vimanas. Now, there are old Indian writings which tell the fuel of this, you know, the energy was coming from different components, and one of the components was mercury. So it's only one of the components for the fuel of the machinery, of the Vimanas. Now they found mercury all over, not only in Maya land, in Central America, also in India, and also in Egypt, in some tombs of high priests. So I believe this mercury they found was just part of the fuel for the Vimanas, for their flying machines.
So perhaps the people of Central America had machines like that. And I mean, what do you, Eric? What do you believe about these pyramid technology? Do you think there's something to this recent research that maybe they were generators of some kind? Does that make sense to you?
No, all the machinery which were there in the past of mankind were not human machinery. It was always the gods who had this machinery. On Earth, there was no development of any technology of flying machines. All the flying machines which were here, which were used, they always came from the gods. And the gods were the extraterrestrials.
The newest book is End of Silence.
The End of Silence, yes. 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 You see, in the meantime, we have more and more knowledge of the old books. These books were existing already. You see, our fathers, our forefathers, some 50, 80, 100 years ago, brilliant people, brilliant professors, they had these books already. But in the past, they made the translation always in a religious and in a psychological sense. In the meantime, we have new possibilities of translations. In the meantime, we see that it was not religion, it was not psychology. So in the meantime, we have scientists, Sumerologists, for example, which make new translations of the old texts. So I say, it's the end of silence. You see, in an old holy text, for example, you have a word like angel. Now ask yourself, what is an angel? Angels are represented, they look like humans, but always they have a helmet on, or some rays, glittering things around their head, and of course they have wings. But these angels were not good guys, they were bad guys. They often destroyed 100,000s of humans. Just read, for example, the second book of the Kings in the Bible. There you see one of the angels descending from the sky, and within a few minutes, he killed 185,000 Assyrians. Now, angels do not use the word angels anymore in the sense of something holy. Just when you see the translation of angel, use the word extraterrestrials. Then we have in the old texts many humans which were brought up to heaven. It was not heaven, it was simply space. So change the word heaven into the word of space. We have words like God, the Almighty God. We have been told, I was told when I was a boy, that heaven is a place of absolutely happiness. Heaven is a place where you go after your life. When you die, you go to heaven, and you are close to God, you are absolutely happy. But in heaven, it was not a place of happiness. In heaven, we had war. That's what the old texts say, including in our religion. You remember maybe in heaven there was a guy, an archangel with the name of Lucifer. Lucifer one day with his disciples went to the throne of the Almighty God and said to the Almighty God, "We do not serve you anymore." Then the Almighty God asked for the help of the archangel Michael, and Michael with his descendants threw out Lucifer from heaven. If heaven would be a place of absolutely happiness because you are close to God, then you have no war in heaven, no opposition. If you are happy, you make no war. So the word heaven, in the sense of something happiness, being close to God, is wrong. Now we just had three words. We changed the word angel into extraterrestrial. We changed the word heaven into space. We changed the word. They were not in heaven. They were up there in spaceship, in mother spaceship. So with this new knowledge, all translations now become a modern sense. That's what I call, it's the end of silence. More
end
and more
silence.
Of these old texts are translated now with the fresh modern meaning.
Okay. Let me just ask you one last question. I'll let you go. And I appreciate the time you're giving me today. What do you believe is the... What's going on with these mass UFO sightings? Are these, I mean, there's a lot of people that believe these are, some of them are earthbound craft that were reverse engineered by the Americans, but there's quite a few craft that appear to be quite unusual in design. Do you have any feeling about those?
Yes. First of all, we definitely have UFOs, which are extraterrestrials, but also we have so-called UFOs, which are man-made. We have both. The extraterrestrial technology is much higher than the technology of the Earthlings. The technology of the extraterrestrials, they have an incredible speed. They make fantastic maneuvers, you know, like angels curving in the sky. Our human technology is compared to the extraterrestrial technology primitive. But we still develop something which we call UFO, which is secret. You know, you Americans, you have the stealth bomber. Stealth bomber was quite, for some years, was a secret. In the meantime, the public know that the stealth bomber exists. But the technology behind it is still secret. No other nation has a stealth bomber. It was developed by the United States. Maybe because they have some help, technological help, by the extraterrestrials. You cannot prove this, but that's one of the options.
Yeah. Eric, thank you very much, and I'm sorry you're uncomfortable.
Thank you for your patience with me.
Yes,
okay.
And
bye-bye.
I will bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Ciao.
Bye. So that was Eric Von Doniggen, and he is in the desert right now at a conference called Contact in the Desert, and it's out in the middle of a small hotel that I'm familiar with. Actually, I've never been there, but I've been talking to people that are at this conference, and they are, it's in a very retro setting, and the air conditioning is zip. So I can imagine it's probably 100 degrees out there or more right now, so we were not able to get our full hour, but I hope you enjoyed that brief interlude with Eric.
So there you go, Eric Von Doniggen. For years it was very, very interesting to read his books, and now I'm just not so sure. I know he's the father of the whole ancient alien movement, the hypothesis that Earth man has been greatly influenced by aliens. And I just can't see it as the influence that he claims that has happened. I do know that the Maya talk about star people, but they typically are less of a huge influence, more of a casual influence, and casual being contact and maybe some exchange of ideas and things like that. But I think the whole hypothesis is it doesn't work. It doesn't work because there's just not enough proof. There's no proof of any individual aliens that have made themselves known. There's no proof of any you could look towards the 12th planet by Zechariah Sitchin and the various Anunnaki Enki and the other off-planet people that were here 400,000 years ago. I don't know. The possibilities, I'm open to the possibilities, and I've studied the subject, but I'm along with Graham Hancock in believing that at one time our planet had extremely sophisticated civilizations on it, and through major cataclysms, they were wiped out. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed the program. My guest next week is going to talk about the pyramids. The book is 2026 Awakening, and the author is Kirk Nielsen, and we're going to talk about the prophecy of the pyramids and what he discovered based on some artifacts he discovered. So I hope you'll come back and you'll join us next week. Have a great day.